Thanks, Andy, and welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming today. This is actually the fifth of the what we call road shows put on by the Terrestrial Biodiversity Network. We're aiming to have eight in each of the capital cities, and so we did four last year, and you're first cab off the rank for this year. That's me. As Andy said, I'm at Macquarie University. I've been involved in NCAF from its inception, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have either through the presentation or at the end about various NCAF matters. So what we're going to do today, I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview. A lot of the sort of global stuff will be fairly familiar to most of you, so I won't spend too long on it. After I do that, Yvette's going to talk specifically about the network. Yvette is our network coordinator who actually does most of the work. Then we'll hand over to Andy, who will do a state overview, and then there'll be a number of other more specific talks through the morning. In the afternoon, as you'll see on the agenda, we'll have more of a workshop structure for everybody to talk to each other. So why are we here? Well, as I said, we've this is the fifth of these state-based roadshows. We still have Tasmania, the Northern Territory, New South Wales to do after this. They're really aimed at bringing about greater understanding of what climate change adaptation actually is, especially in terms of environmental adaptation. Adaptation in climate change is the newest part of climate change research. It's still a fairly immature science, I think, but these roadshows are aimed specifically at increasing understanding and also simply to get people to meet each other within their own state. We're really aiming to try to increase the role of stakeholders in agencies, bring them together with researchers to do climate change adaptation research. Our outcomes, we hope, are raising awareness of climate change adaptation and of what the network and NCAF can provide individuals, increasing collaboration, and as Andy said, there will be a summary of these talks and of the workshop notes this afternoon available on the website very soon. Overall, what we want you to think about today is how you think the national priorities that have been identified in the National Adaptation Research Plan and other documents might be appropriate for your ecosystem, your region, your particular sector. Is there anything major that was missed out? We want to hear about that so that it will get incorporated next time. What are the specific priorities and challenges in your region of interest? What research you think we need to do to respond to those challenges, and what are the main impediments holding us back. So a very brief overview about global climate change. I'm not going to dwell on this because I think most of you, the fact that you're here means that you probably know quite a bit of this stuff already. Firstly, is the climate changing? Well, and are people causing it? I hope there's nobody here in the room that doesn't believe that. If you are, I'll speak with you privately later. There are now a number of really great publications, the latest one being this one produced by the Australian Academy of Sciences, which I would recommend to you if you want a handy kind of guide to hand out to your friends at dinner parties, that sort of thing, questions and answers about climate change. You know, I think it is incumbent on all of us to become better at communicating the issues and reaching out to the public and the community. There are also many, many other documents. Most of them are available off the Terrestrial Biodiversity Network website, which are more specific to different states and different sectors. So please avail yourself of that information that we're collating all the time. So what's been happening in Australia? Well, of course, it's been getting a lot hotter. This is the trend in mean temperatures 1970 to 2009. And as you can see, most of Australia's been getting hotter, except for perhaps possibly up in the northwest of the region. We are also getting wetter in some places and drier in others. So the brown areas is where we've been getting wetter over the last four decades. Green areas where we've been getting wetter, brown areas where we've been getting drier. And as we're all aware, especially down the east coast and in the southwest of Western Australia, things have been getting a lot drier, though up in the northwest of Western Australia, we're seeing increased rainfall. We're continuously breaking records, and it's particularly apposite to talk about this over the last couple of weeks that we've had in Australia. In fact, somebody yesterday that I was talking to in Sydney, where I came from, that discovered I was going to Adelaide for the day, they said, well, that must be one of the few capital cities in Australia that's not either broken a climate record or undergone some sort of natural disaster in the last 2 weeks. So hopefully that's not a portent. But briefly, seven out of the top 10 hottest years ever recorded have been in the last decade. That's globally as well as nationally. Last year was the hottest ever in Australia. July 2010, the hottest ever July. In Sydney on Saturday night, for example, the highest ever minimum temperature overnight recorded since temperature records began. Everybody was extremely cranky and unable to sleep. Increasing extreme events, and of course the last 2 weeks has been a testament to that. The IPCC projections for future temperatures are really, really scary. The green bits are what we've had pretty much already, and as you can see, there's a number of different scenarios for the future. The really high one almost doesn't bear thinking about, but they're all going up, depending on all sorts of assumptions that are made about things like energy technology, population growth, etc. But in summary, we're facing higher average temperatures, more frequent and more intense heat waves, changing rainfall patterns, increased frequency and intensity of drought, increasing fire weather and incidents of extreme fire days, and in mountainous areas, a higher cloud base. So what will happen to the natural environment, which is what we're all interested in? The IPCC report in 2007 very clearly identified the natural environment and biodiversity as the most vulnerable sector of all sectors. I don't know what quite happened there, so let's talk about adaptation. I should say here that I'm actually speaking to my co-convener Steve Williams' slide, so if I look occasionally nonplussed about a slide that's come up, it's because I didn't actually put the presentation together. Okay, we've already had lots of observed impacts of climate change, lots of observed impacts that are very consistent with having a climate change signal. We've already seen changes in the distribution and abundance, particularly of mobile species such as pelagic marine species, birds and insects. The phenology, that is the timing of species life cycles, is changing, and there's extremely good and consistent evidence, particularly of many life cycle events occurring earlier in the year, things like migration of birds, breeding, flowering, fruiting, etc. We're starting to pick up changes in the physiology of some species. Interactions between species are changing as species move around and their life cycles change. It means that the other species that they bump into are also changing. We will get the interaction of climate change with all sorts of other existing stresses, and you can think of climate change simply as a new stress on ecosystems on top of all of the stresses that they're already dealing with, like habitat fragmentation, fire, invasive species, etc. And we're already starting to see changes in disease dynamics, and this is particularly evident on coral reefs, where we're starting to get the emergence of new diseases that simply haven't been seen before. This is an example of a rather controversial paper published in Nature in 2004, of which Steve Williams and I were both co-authors, and it estimated, using some fairly simple techniques, that up to about 18 to 35% of all species might be potentially committed to extinction simply due to a shrinking of their bioclimatic range in the future, or at least highly threatened by climate change. Now, the numbers aren't exactly, you know, important. The real point is that there's an awful lot of species out there that may be in real trouble. So what can we do? Well, there's two basic things, of course, we can do. One is to fix the cause of the problem, which is the mitigation side of the equation, by reducing emissions and sequestering more carbon, and at least the government is now seriously considering a price on carbon to deal with that. But the other side of the coin is that even if mitigation is quite successful, the lag times in the climate system means that we are going to be facing inevitably very significant climatic changes, and we need to adapt to those. Hence this network. This is from Steve. I think it just sort of sums up, I think, the frustration that I think we have all felt with the lack of leadership in Australia and elsewhere on this issue. Nobody wants to go first. The importance of real significant mitigation, I think, is really well illustrated in this graph. Without mitigation, we're looking at that red future. With very significant mitigation, we might be lucky enough to only get that blue future, which is about an increase of average temperature of 2 degrees on top of what we had in 1990. I think most climate change scientists are fairly pessimistic about the opportunities that we have to only hit the blue band, and I think most of us think that we're much more likely to miss that, overshoot it, and go at least part of the way into that red band. So the point is, can we adapt enough in human systems and natural systems? The IPCC did identify that most human systems, at least in developing countries like Australia, do have opportunities to adapt. Though, of course, if everybody keeps going and building the same sort of houses in the same sort of places that just got flooded or blown down by a cyclone, it would illustrate that people are still in denial about the future. But it's much more difficult to understand how the natural ecosystem will adapt and what we can help it with. So back to this IPCC graph again then. At the lower end of this, you know, we probably don't need to do very much. Just hang out where we are. It's really at that intermediate band where adaptation is going to be critical. If we get to that upper part of the red area, you know, frankly, it doesn't really matter what we do. It will be too late. So it's that real intermediate area of the climate scenarios where adaptation will be absolutely crucial. Which brings us to NCAF. The National Climate Change Adaptation Facility was an initiative actually of the Howard government, you might be shocked to discover. It's based at Griffith University's Gold Coast campus. The government at the time allocated about $117 million 2008 to 2012 to climate change adaptation policies and research, of which $10 million went to run NCAF, $10 million to the 8 networks, and $30 million for direct research funding. These are the key roles, the sort of the NCAF vision to help, firstly, a series of national adaptation research plans. There are 9 of these in various stages of development, to identify critical gaps in information and to be available to decision makers, to also synthesise and channel emerging national and international research on climate change impacts and adaptation, and to also develop better ways of communicating those products widely, to undertake a specific program of integrative research to address the identified national priorities, and to establish and maintain 8 adaptation research networks. The networks are these. We're all here from the Terrestrial Biodiversity Network, but there is also a network for water resources and freshwater biodiversity, marine biodiversity and resources, primary industries, human health, emergency management, settlements and infrastructure, and social, economic and institutional dimensions. I should mention there's 8 networks, there are 9 research plans. There is the 9th plan is an Indigenous research plan, which arose kind of at a later stage when it was really decided that the existing research plans did not give sufficient coverage of Indigenous issues, and it was decided to write a separate plan for that. The role of each of the networks is fourfold. Firstly, to promote and facilitate open exchange of information and the sharing of resources, to synthesise existing and emerging research, to contribute to the development of those plans and to build capacity, especially amongst young investigators and research students in this research field. I'll share with you an anecdote on this last point. In the year 2003, I was asked to give a talk at the Ecological Society of Australia meeting in Cairns to a group of postgrads. So this was about 80 to 100 students doing PhDs who came along for a special day before the main conference. And before they came, they were asked to identify what region or what aspect of research they were doing, and climate change was one of the boxes that they could have ticked. And of those 80 students in 2003, not one single student picked the climate change box, which was a shock to me at the time. I do think there's been a tremendous increase in interest in climate change research since that. And in fact, the last couple of conferences, and Mike Bull will agree with me, I think, is that it seemed like the majority of talks were on climate change. So I think there has been a tremendous acceleration of research interest by young investigators in this area. So to get more specifically to our network then, our real interest is to provide policymakers, decision makers with information to help develop strategies that will promote adaptation to climate change, specifically in terrestrial ecosystems. The network's convened by Steve Williams at James Cook and myself, and as I said, Yvette Williams is the coordinator who does most of the work. We have an excellent steering committee with representatives from each state, including Andy and Barry Brook here in South Australia. The steering committee meets about three or four times a year to discuss what we're going to do. The network is distributed broadly across the nation, and it's been very much our philosophy to both distribute membership and to distribute activities of the members across the nation. The network structure is that we have an overarching... our overarching leadership comes from NCAF at Griffith. The steering committee sits below that. And then we now have over 1,000 members in the network. It's the largest of the networks. It's grown extremely rapidly. And those 1,000 members come from over 200 institutions. So it's a tremendous resource base of potential collaboration. And then the networks are also externally linked to many other networks and other bodies such as the Commonwealth Environment Research Facility and various agencies. Our primary goals: to develop explicit and practical strategies to increase resilience in terrestrial systems, to maximise the potential of those systems in the face of climate change, and most of all to foster an inclusive collaborative research environment. In other words, link experts together, get people together, such as in gatherings like this, to share information, to collaborate, to reduce duplication, to facilitate exchange and to encourage training and development, to make a difference in the end. So as an example, I'm actually going to talk about some of Steve's research, so I will apologise to him in absentia if I really stuff it up, but we're using Steve's research as an example to really show how we can move from basic monitoring through to understanding potential impacts through to adaptation strategies. So I hope I do it some justice. Steve works up in the rainforests of the Australian wet tropics. This area is known as a biodiversity hotspot and has an extraordinary both species... absolute species richness, but also enormous richness of endemic species found nowhere else. And we're talking about the Wet Tropics World Heritage Area, which is about 10,000 square kilometres of rainforest, stretching from Townsville up to Cooktown. I think those arrows refer to elevational transects that Steve's research group has been studying for many years, and they have developed an extraordinary database of biological information by doing regular sampling up the up the mountains within the wet tropics at 200 metre intervals. They've got standardised survey data for birds, reptiles, general spotlight data, frogs, and various flying insects, and that just shows you just the sort of the enormous numbers of surveys that have been done up there. What Steve's group has been trying to do is to use this data to firstly assess vulnerability of these species, habitats and ecosystems and ecosystem processes to prioritise responses and to understand, well, what can, is there anything we can do, and if so, what can we do? In the wet tropics, just as in any other ecosystem, that is an enormous challenge. Understanding what might happen to even a single species in the future is challenging enough. Understanding what will happen when all those species interact within a community and an ecosystem is a really complex task. And I'm just putting up this figure from one of Steve's papers to show how many different components of understanding are potentially involved in just measuring vulnerability, let alone what to do about that vulnerability. This is an example of some bioclimatic modelling of the golden bowerbird up there, looking at what might happen to the distribution, the bioclimatic distribution of that bowerbird as the temperature increases. I think I just need to keep hitting this button until the golden bowerbird basically pretty much goes extinct if it is limited by current climatic relationships. Here's a similar series of animations showing their predicted overall rainforest species richness under several different climatic scenarios as the temperature increases. And Steve's group has put a lot of this stuff together and summarised it in this way. So if we look at the temperature increase on the x-axis and the number of species affected on the y-axis, at, for example, where that black line is at 3 degrees temperature increase above 1990, we're looking at only about 35% of the existing species still finding a bioclimatic envelope that they currently occupy. Right down to about 30% having lost their bioclimatic envelope completely, and the rest in various shades of trouble in between. So given this potentially enormous problem in the future that this ecosystem faces, the real question is what can be done, where we've got 84% of the species actually relying on little pockets of cooler area, cool refugia, in this wet tropics World Heritage Area. So a lot of the work that Steve's group's been doing is been aimed at understanding where those cool refugia are and what could be done to protect them in the future. So how questions like where are they, where will they be in the future, how large do these refugia need to be under different scenarios to be effective, which species will benefit from them, what factors might threaten them in the future, and how do we protect, enhance and manage them. Here's a map showing, once again, several slices of the World Heritage Area to just show the various sorts of environmental measurements that the group has been making overlaid on each other to find these precious refugia in the landscape. Sorry. Once again, I'm struggling to channel Steve into my head with these slides. I think what this slide shows is those the bluer the area, the better and cooler the refugia that they have identified. So that's where they are predicted to be. This leads to the possibility of there being several adaptation options in relation to these cool refugia. So some of them, based on overlaying the distributions of about 200 rainforest vertebrate species, and they just picked seven of the global climate change models and are just showing a sort of a slice that, okay, if we get a 4 degree on average increase, those pink arrows there refer to where those refugia might be. And then we can break down and look at those refugia and what their current land use is and what we might do about them in the future. So here's a couple that have been identified that are already in a protected area. So all you would need to do or could do under those circumstances would be to manage the other stresses that might affect those refugia, particularly the impacts